Welcome to the Are Your Hands Full podcast, a step-by-step parenting podcast for your Jewish family. My name is Dr. S. Yaroslavitz, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Please check out the most recent Are Your Hands Full download at www.handsfullchinuch.com. That's handsfullchinuch.com. Been thinking about topics that you would like to hear me speak about on this Nishmas Hayomi hotline. I will likely answer one question at a time in order to give each question the thorough attention it deserves. I will also delete identifying details for two reasons. Firstly, the obvious reason is that everybody deserves their confidentiality and their privacy. So for this reason, I'll sometimes change the gender of the child, and sometimes not. If it becomes important, I might change the location and the demographics of the child, and sometimes not. So don't spend your precious energy trying to figure out who asked the question, because that's not the point of this hotline, and it's certainly not the point of these discussions. The purpose of these discussions on Nishmas Hayomi is for parents to concentrate and learn about behavior management, its theoretical underpinnings, and how they may or may not apply to your child. So if you're spending mental energy trying to figure out whose question I'm addressing, that's a waste of time and a waste of cognition. Another important point before we start. There will be times when, as I answer questions, I might quote the literature. If any of you would like to know who I was referencing in a particular statement, please feel free to call in and ask, and I will get back to you. I keep all the references on file, but it's a bit cumbersome to state them all as I'm recording. Just know that they are there, on file, should anyone be curious about them. I will also do my best to answer as many questions as possible each week. I apologize to those whose questions need to wait until the next recording, but rest assured that with Rabban Shalom's help, I will do my best to get to each and every one of your questions. So this week, a question came in that is so important and essential that it deserves immediate and thorough attention. The question came in as follows. My child struggles socially. He knows he's different. He's uncomfortable in his own skin. Primarily, his behavior is aggressive. He's hitting, he's kicking, he's bothering other children. But as soon as he is on his own, he's like a malach, he's like an angel. I would love to use behavior management strategies to teach him how to behave with other children, but I am reluctant because it feels to me as if his behaviors are coming from an emotional place, and I don't want to neglect his emotional health. What should I do? Great, great question. In order to answer the question, we first have to define two major concepts. The first, behavior. The second, emotion. Before I give you the actual definition of the two concepts, the first thing you must always remember is that behaviors are observable and measurable, and emotions are not. That means that a behavior exits the body in the form of an action that another person can see and can measure, and emotions do not. So if I feel anger, the outside world won't be able to observe or measure my anger until I translate that emotion into a behavior such as shout, hit, speaking using bad language, or whatever. Now to define the two concepts. Behavior is, this is according to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, anything that an organism does involving action and response to stimulation. Notice the word does. Or the way, here's another one, or the way in which one acts or conducts oneself, especially toward others. And here's another one. Behavior is an action that is observable and measurable. Behavior is observable. You can see it. Another person can see it. It is what we hear or see, such as a child sitting down, standing up, speaking, whispering, yelling, or writing. Now let's talk about emotion. Emotions, here's the definition, are mental states brought on by neurophysiological changes variously associated with thoughts, feelings, behavioral responses, and a degree of pleasure or displeasure. So I think by now the definition for behavior is clear. Behaviors are actions. Someone else has to be able to see a behavior in order for it to be considered a behavior. So for example, sadness is an emotion. Crying is the behavior. Happiness is an emotion. Clapping one's hands, a behavior. I think you get the drift. Now comes emotion. Let's repeat its definition. Emotions are mental states brought on by neurophysiological changes variously associated with thoughts, feelings, behavioral responses, and a degree of pleasure or displeasure. Listen to what this definition is stating. It's stating that emotions are brought on by changes in the brain, which are influenced by thoughts, feelings, behavioral responses, etc. Notice behavioral responses. What's that all about? How do behavioral responses influence emotion? That's exactly what the definition is trying to tell us. The definition is trying to tell us that our emotions are like a spiral staircase. We feel, thus we behave. But our behaviors get replowed into our psyche, and we feel again based on how we just responded. Then we behave again, based on those new feelings, and again those behaviors plow back into the equation, and thus we feel again. So for example, if my child frustrates me, and I get angry and yell, the fact that I shouted influences my next set of feelings. But if I control myself when my child frustrates me, then the self-control that I accomplished influences my feelings moving forward. Makes sense. Chazal cut to the chase and phrased this far more eloquently than anyone in the literature can. The Chinuch, in his Sefer HaChinuch, says, Da, ki adam nifal kefi pu'ulosav. No, he's writing this Sefer to his son, that a person becomes a product of his actions, vilibo, and his heart, v'chol machshavosav, and all of his thoughts, tamid achar ma'asav shehu osek bahem. They always follow the actions that he's busy with, im tov, whether good, v'im ra, or whether bad. This is a very strong statement. Chinuch is not saying that sometimes a behavior can determine how we feel. He's saying that libo, his heart, v'chol machshavosav, and all of his thoughts always follow his actions, always follow his ma'asim. Wow. Tamid, always. Strong stuff. But this correlates very well with na'aseh v'nishma. We accept the Torah this way. First we do, and then we listen, and then we think, and then we feel. But first we do. It's funny. Every single one of us sat in school and learned the story about the Malach who ran around to all the nations of the world and asked them if they wanted the Torah, right? And this nation asked, what's in the Torah? That nation asked, what's in the Torah, right? You remember this. You know the story. And then when the Malach got to the Yidden, they just answered, Na'aseh v'nishma, we will do, and then we will listen. That's behavior. That's who we are as Yidden. We behave first, and then we look around and figure out the rest. And our huge Eibusha, who looked into the Torah first and then created us, right? Estakel v'oraisa u'bara alma, knows exactly what makes us feel best. And according to him, we feel better after we do better, not the reverse. So now let's get back to the question. Our caller said that she wants to work on her child's behaviors, but she feels that the behaviors are coming from his emotions and feels a need to take care of the emotions first. Indeed, it is common for many parents to be told by clinicians that their child's behaviors are not fixable until they get to the emotional root or cause of the behavior. But what if we don't know the emotional cause of the behaviors? And what if we think we know the cause, but the cause is irreversible, it's permanent? Or worse yet, what if the beginning of the emotional root of the behavior was there and became worse because of all the negative behavioral responses that were allowed to pile one on top of the other on top of this original emotional root? What if the opportunity to reverse the emotional route was missed because it wasn't easily accessible? And now it became much, much worse because years and years of negative behaviors shaped the child. So what should we do then? Wait around for the lifespan of the child and spend it searching for roots and causes that are not so available? After all, emotions are inside the individual, not observable, not measurable. If there is so much guesswork attached to emotional analysis, is that the best place to start? I propose that you work differently. Start with the behaviors. Focus on them, model them, shape them. Put the possible emotional causes on hold. Don't get frightened, you're not hurting anyone. Give it a 3-month trial. And after 3 months, you will have a clear answer to your question. Here's a story that happened to me about a decade ago, which will give you even further clarity.
The date was August 7th, 2012. It was the day of my doctoral dissertation, the day I would become a doctor. It was a day filled with the "today is the first day of the rest of your life" feeling. My online doctoral work at University of Oklahoma's Rehabilitation Science Department, especially designed for occupational and physical therapists, had involved 36 long months of round-the-clock, 24/6, unbearably difficult academic work, which included writing hundreds of articles and papers, taking multiple tests, 2 24-hour exams, 3 years of research, and finally the moment of truth, an oral dissertation to be followed by a defense. During the defense, an audience of professors who had studied the topic of my research were invited to challenge my thesis and grade my ability to defend my research position. My research topic was a study of family health in Haredi second and third generation survivors of the Holocaust. I flash back to the day the decision was made to study my people, descendants of survivors of the Holocaust. My supervisor knew nothing about the Holocaust. How could I expect her to? After all, how much Holocaust education exists in Oklahoma City? But she wanted to study the family health of any population of my choosing, and so I chose our people, offspring of those who had survived the Holocaust, people who are not strangers to adversity, to hard work, to determination, people who are not afraid to fall, pick themselves up, and forge onward. And so for the next 3 years, I lived and breathed survivors, survivor syndrome, survivor parenting skills, survivor communication skills, survivor value systems, survivor fears, survivor trauma. The list was endless. Finally, the results of all the statistical studies were complete. My PowerPoint presentation was prepared. Suddenly, I found myself in front of an audience of 75 professors. None were Jewish. They were polite and extremely attentive. They were curious about Holocaust survivors, a population that is so unfamiliar to them, yet so familiar to us. I delivered my PowerPoint presentation, smooth, without a hitch. I noticed the audience passing around tissues. They were clearly moved. They understood. They were impressed with the challenges we face and the tools we use to overcome them. Then the questions began. Most of them were about my research strategies, about logistics. How did I find these people? Oh, no problem, just come to my neck of the woods and roam the streets. You'll find them a dime a dozen, I told them. Slowly and carefully, I answered each question. The audience began to shift in their seats, indicating that they were running out of questions. I remained quiet, expectant, not daring to allow myself to breathe yet. Almost there, I told myself. Hang in there, almost there. And just at that point, a pleasant-looking professor stood up. He had a question. I intuitively braced myself again. He said, "In anticipation of your dissertation, I did some reading and studied Haredim. I found a few articles that indicated that Haredim resist therapy and medications designed to battle mental health diagnoses and would rather bury their problems under the rug. At this point, my heart dropped a mile, and whatever breaths I thought I might have the luxury of breathing were placed on hold. You see, I knew where he was headed, and I had absolutely no idea how I was going to feel the question that was on its way. "Why," he continued, "is there anything in the Haredi culture or religion that negates taking care of oneself, of helping oneself, of curing oneself? If survivors of 9/11, the Oklahoma City bombing, and Hurricane Katrina accept the help they need, why don't your people do the same?" I was stuck, bein ha-patish v'ha-sudden, between a rock and a hard place. Answer such a question and expose our vulnerabilities to a non-Jew? Never, not a chance. Describe some of our perceptions of therapists and mental health clinicians to someone who had spent a lifetime in this field and risk failing my dissertation? Not so smart. I was stuck. At precisely that moment, Hashem miraculously provided me with the perfect response. I said to him, "If you have researched the Haredi culture and religion, you must be familiar with our Sabbath. You might also know that because Sabbath, the day of rest, involves refraining from cooking, cleaning, and bathing, our preparations for the Sabbath render Friday a very busy day. Either way, at sundown, on Friday, every woman who has gotten married approaches a table upon which a candelabra or candles have been set. She lights the candles and takes a moment to recite a special blessing and a prayer over them. This ceremony heralds the onset of this Sabbath." The audience was interested. They had clearly never been exposed to Shabbos. I took a deep breath and plunged onward. "I must be honest with you," I said. "Although I would like to tell you that I am always ready to light the candles when the time arrives, I cannot. There are some Fridays that I approach the candles with a few moments to spare. During those moments, I take time to connect to the one above by reciting a chapter or two of Psalms. Those moments are very special. But then I must confess, there are times that I arrive at that table as if on roller skates at the last second, and that doesn't feel right." I stopped for effect. "Either way," I continued, speaking very slowly, "I light those candles on time." I saw the beginnings of understanding dawn on their faces. I know clinicians might say that an action is only worthwhile if a person has attained readiness. Based on this, they might tell a woman that if she is on roller skates on one Friday, it would be fine if she were to skip candle lighting and wait until a better week. This advice would be counterintuitive to a Haredi and would therefore be culturally inappropriate. It would be analogous to traveling the wrong way down a one-way street. I stopped. The audience nodded its collective head. They were experiencing the fundamental truth of Adam Nifal Kafi Pu'losav. "And do you know what happens when a woman happens to skip candle lighting on a Friday evening?" I asked them. They did not, but the look on their faces indicated that they were expecting some graphic discussion of some deep level of Gehenna. A therapist might say, "Get to the root of the problem. Work with the woman to find out why she forgot to light candles. Find out why she is not emotionally ready to light candles and work on her emotional status until candle lighting becomes natural to her, right?" I asked them. They nodded their heads. "Well," I explained, "Judaism believes otherwise. Judaism believes that extra action will change the individual on the inside to the extent that this woman will not forget to light her candles again." "So," I continued, "nothing much happens other than she lights an extra candle for every Sabbath for the rest of her life." No fancy explanations, discussions, and digging into the depth of her soul. Simply more action. Additional candle lighting. Another candle. That's all. Then I tied the whole thing together. And this, my colleagues, is the beauty of occupational therapy. Occupational therapy is about occupation, about performance, about function. Its framework espouses the patient's becoming based on activity. There, I had said it, Nase v'nishma, Yidin do first, unconditionally, no matter what. The pleasant-looking professor who had asked the original question smiled. He clearly liked my answer. Hodu Lashem. And then he said, based on your answer, I see that we're going to have to train many Haredi therapists, right? But I smiled and did not appreciate the depth of his statement. At that time, all I really wanted was my doctorate. So hopefully this discussion provided you with a starting point. Behaviors are much more easily accessed than emotion. And if you begin to shape your child's behaviors for the positive, your child's emotions will change. You won't be neglecting your child's emotional health. On the contrary, you will enhance it. Generally, when I apply the Hands Full program for children who are developing normally, we need a minimum of 6 weeks until we start to see change. I'm going to be doubling that amount of time for you, for a child who is growing up with special needs. If you stay committed to what you are doing and don't doubt yourself or the angle of approach to your child's behaviors, you will likely begin to see change after that time. At this time, I think it's best for listeners to spend this next week allowing the concepts of this lecture to percolate in their minds. Understand that your access point to your child's emotions is through his behaviors. If you truly understand this concept and are ready to begin learning some general strategies, feel free to leave another message on the Nishma Saini hotline. Thanks for listening to my podcast. My name is Dr. S. Yaroslavitz, and I am the director of Hands Full, which is committed to the provision of community education in the area of behavior management and cognitive development of children. I look forward to hearing from you with any questions that you have. And remember, no matter how impossible things may seem, the Earth will continue rotating on its axis.